This is Dylan FM, a Freak Music Club podcast. I'm Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place. This season, we're going deep on Time Out of Mind to celebrate its 25th anniversary. Here's your host, Craig Danieloff.
Many of us grew up in a world where Bob Dylan was not only a major figure in music and pop culture, but where his work was already considered in a serious way, not only by his fans, but also by credentialed scholars in literature, poetry, and art. Today, Dylan is a Nobel Prize winner for literature. There have been a nearly endless stream of other prestigious acknowledgments and awards, and there are dozens of scholarly books that have been written about him by respected writers, professors. He is taken very seriously in every conceivable way. But all of this had to start somewhere. We know Dylan's origin story well. He burst upon the scene already a legend, as Ms. Baez said. But as our entire culture demonstrates, you can be a legend or a phenomenon without being taken very seriously. In 1966, Dylan inspired Paul Williams, in part, to create what the New York Times called the first magazine to take rock and roll seriously. Today's guest took that seriousness to another level when he wrote the book Song and Dance Man, which was released 50 years ago in 1972. At that point, just to provide some context, there were just 10 Dylan albums, ending with New Morning. There had been a few small, kind of teeny bopper fan club books in print, although Anthony Scuto's first serious biography was also just hitting the streets. But Song and Dance Man was different. The subtitle tells the story. It's about the art of Bob Dylan, and it takes a serious critical look at what made Dylan's early work special. Michael's writing deeply considers Dylan's words, but also from literally the first page of his book, he acknowledges that Dylan is writing and performing songs, which have many vital components beyond the words. I should mention that Song and Dance Man has been updated twice over the years and greatly expanded along the way, all the way through Time Out of Mind. It's unfortunately no longer in print, but it's easy and reasonable to pick up a copy on eBay. The most recent version has Dylan in a top hat on the cover. I should also say that he does have a new book on Dylan, this one called Outtakes on Bob Dylan. It's a collection of his writings from the beginning in 1967, all the way through 2021 with a chapter on Rough and Rowdy Ways. I'll put a link in the show notes if you want to grab one for yourself or for someone else. One of the things I really like about Michael Gray is that he is not unapologetically enthusiastic about everything Bob Dylan does. He is, in fact, critical, although still thoughtfully, of much of Bob Dylan's work, or certain aspects of Bob Dylan's work, I should say. But he can explain why, and it's both interesting and educational to hear these opinions, whether or not you find them convincing. While Michael has literally written the Bob Dylan Encyclopedia, a phone book-sized volume with entries on everything and everyone in Dylan's sphere, I asked him in this discussion to talk to us about Time Out of Mind. It's a work on which he's written much, and on which, in some cases, he has changed his mind publicly after making some quite declarative statements. It's an album on which he has, as you'll hear, a lot to say, things that can help all of us to better consider and appreciate this great album. Michael Gray studied history and English at York University, and he interviewed Jimi Hendrix as a student journalist. In addition to the aforementioned books on Bob Dylan, he's written books on Frank Zappa and Blind Willie McTell. He's given hundreds of speeches and lectures all over the world and was a visiting fellow at Girton College in Cambridge. He's written for Rolling Stone, The Times, Uncut, and many, many others. And now, here's my conversation with Michael Gray. Review. I reread the whole Time Out of Mind thing last night.
I reread it this morning for the first time in many years, and I thought how bloody good it was.
Well, I agree with you. Why don't we start with the essay in Song and Dance Man, specifically your thoughts about Time Out of Mind. And what's interesting there is you start with your original thoughts. Maybe you can summarize those for us a little bit.
You know, this was the first new album for quite a while of Dylan's own songs. And it absolutely took me by surprise that suddenly the media all over the Western world said, hey, Bob Dylan, he's still around, and this is a great album. Because, you know, this was an era of extreme kind of up, don't ever say anything negative. And also Dylan had been, for most of the 1990s, a completely sort of forgotten figure. I believe that Columbia Records didn't even bother to keep track of where he was on tour for a good deal of that decade. And then suddenly, everyone is suddenly interested in Bob Dylan again, even though the album appears to be, certainly on early hearings, one of the most miserable, doom-laden albums that you could possibly come up with. I mean, nothing up about it at all. So my first impression was just enormous surprise that it was so well-received. My second impression was that a good deal of the doom and misery was not necessarily all that authentic. Some of it was very lazily written, and some of it was... there was a kind of roughness to the vocal that didn't necessarily convince on every track, you know. But my second impression was also that there were four major songs on this album, and they were Standing in the Doorway, Not Dark Yet, Trying to Get to Heaven, and Highlands. And I've never changed my mind about that. I think they are four major songs, and I think they're the only four major songs on an otherwise rather patchy album. So, you know, I'm aware that your sort of 25-year celebration of Time Out of Mind should be almost totally a positive celebration of this landmark album. But for me, you know, if you come to me for a total thumbs up about this record, you've come to the wrong place.
Michael, one of the things I really enjoy reading your work is the fact that you aren't afraid and have the ability to discern the good from the medium, from the great, from the bad, and that you call it out, because I think ultimately it generates a lot of credibility, especially since you very articulately explain what and why. The comments you make about Make You Feel My Love and Million Miles and some of those songs that you think are less than stellar, I think is very handy. And I think it helps everyone understand the album better. And, you know, everyone's free to think what they want.
Million Miles, I said it in the book, and it's still very striking to me. This is a song about, you know, feeling alienated from and or a long way away from somebody else. And whether the narrator of the song is Bob Dylan or a character doesn't matter. The repeated title line, I'm still a million miles from you. There's nothing concrete about that image. It's just a kind of exaggerated expression. It has no kind of life to it. Whereas on One Too Many Mornings, decades earlier, when Bob was young and fresh and his work was perhaps less professional, but certainly more full-on artistic, perhaps, he has a similar expression for a comparable situation. And that is One Too Many Mornings and a Thousand Miles Behind. And there you have that expression of distance, as in, I'm still a million miles from you. But on the earlier expression, he's invented it. It's creative. And in bumping together the phrase One Too Many Mornings and the phrase And a Thousand Miles, linking them with Behind, he is talking about distance of time and place in one creative couple of lines that are just his and that we had never heard before he rolled along and made them. Whereas we've all heard, you know, God, I've got a million things to do and all that stuff. That's just one example. But it was a very clear one to me early on.
So interestingly then, in the Song and Dance Man version of the book, you finish 2.5-3 pages of this, I wouldn't say lukewarm, because you register the four songs that you like very much. And then you have a very startling short phrase, "I was wrong." and then you explain your view. Tell us about when that reevaluation took place and how did that come over for you, and explain a little bit about what you say that reevaluation was.
Well, I think the gap between the first few pages and then the "I was wrong" was a gap between 5 or 6 first hearings of the album, when, you know, it wasn't what I wanted my Bob Dylan album to be, which is, you know, not Bob's fault. And then coming to have to analyze it in detail for the book. And I should say that when I reread this chapter, it's the penultimate chapter of Song and Dance Man 3, okay? And this was published in Britain in the last 2 weeks of 1999, and in America early in 2000. So, you know, we're talking about something I wrote over 20 years ago. And the album itself, of course, is 25 years old, more or less now. What I would say when I reread it, this chapter, in order to talk to you about these things, was that I liked the fact that what I do with this stuff is looking in great detail at particular effects of particular lines, words, phrases. And of course, the more that you can make yourself do that very detailed, more disciplined work, the more likely you are to derive more from an album, and the less likely you are to miss subtleties. And there are plenty, you know, in the album. And some of them are strengths that Dylan has always displayed. Strengths like his lovely use of half rhymes. You know, in Lovesick, where he rhymes meadow with window with shadow. It's very nice. It's careful. It's not a sloppiness. It's not like one of those things where it's just mind and time as a rhyme, which, you know, you could call it a half rhyme, but it's just a loose rhyme. But meadow, window, shadow, that's carefully constructed. That's admirable, of course. And there's a wonderful one in Highlands where he says, took the napkin and took it back end, blah, blah, blah. So that napkin and back end is a half rhyme. There's another one where he says, he rhymes forget. It's, I wish I'd never met you, trying to forget you. And instead of forget as a perfect rhyme with met, he says git. He says forget, so that he makes met and git like a half rhyme instead of a whole rhyme. It's just a nice vocal touch. I mean, it may have been entirely accidental and uncalculated, but that's art at work, you know.
Two of the things that struck me that you summarize is you call it a real Bob Dylan album, and then you kind of echo that at the end of your piece.
I'm not particularly comfortable with that phrase. I think it's, you know, I kind of regret using that phrase because it implies that there are phony Bob Dylan albums, of course. And what I say at the beginning about songs like Can't Wait and Till I Fell in Love with You is that they are phony. But the album, I shouldn't be dismissing any of his albums as just, you know, a phony album. There are albums that are obviously far more minor albums. You know, I mean, nobody with any sense is going to tell me that Together Through Life is on any kind of a par with Blood on the Tracks or even with Desire. But certainly it would be difficult to justify saying that any entire album is not a real Dylan album. Sometimes, you know, you hear him and he's completely trustworthy. What you're hearing is an authentic voice. It may not be, you know, revealingly autobiographical. That's not what he says he's doing, and it's not what he very often does at all. You know, you can invent a character and that character can sing the song. But sometimes that narrative voice sounds completely convincing and sometimes less convincing. And really, I should have been less sweeping in my dividing up of whole album. Because actually, you know, if you press me to say, well, what is a phony or fake Bob Dylan album, I couldn't justifiably give you an answer. I could only tell you the albums I don't like.
But it does, you know, the specific word aside, it does suggest that you put it in a group near the top and you consider it a major work, I think is another phrase that you use. And I think the big conclusion you came to, a reevaluation, was that the overall sound, feel, theme, mood was meaningful and consistent.
I think the more I listen to the detail of the words, and I am much better on words than music, the more there was within those words that was worth real consideration, you know, and words that give off real interest, have a real beguiling quality, even in some of the songs that I musically don't like. And I think that the four major songs are so strong that whatever the rest of the album is like, it would still be a major album. I mean, that's in artistic terms. In terms of his career, of course, it was a huge album because it really revived a career. I've known loads of people who said, and this is what the British Review said as well. They more or less said, you know, I gave up on Bob Dylan when he went evangelical, and then suddenly I find, hey, he's palatably secular again, and has a kind of gravitas of the middle-aged artist. Whereas, you know, much as the evangelical albums had their problematic aspect, I didn't go away from him. And if I had gone away from him at that point, it wouldn't have needed time out of mind to bring me back. I'd have been brought back by World Gone Wrong at the very least.
I thought the highlighting of the phrase "when things disintegrate" was a great call out in terms of a summation of the theme or mood or recurring.
Yes.
Conversation on this album.
Yes, it really is the theme of the album, isn't it? Things are disintegrating. They have disintegrated. I have no optimism left. You know, my sense of humanity has gone down the drain. I mean, this is very dark expressions and very dark sentiments being expressed here. And in the song "Not Dark Yet," expressed very beautifully, and there are parts of that kind of take on the world, on life, on the life of someone middle aged, that that crop up well in every song. Sometimes the music just gets in the way of that to me. You were talking a few minutes ago about it having a sort of overall sound, or perhaps you were attributing that to me. But actually, you know, I was re-listening to it yesterday very closely, and it doesn't seem to me that it has an overall sound at all. You know, some of the four major songs are beautifully recorded, and the vocals are clear and crisp, and they are, if you like, less Lanois, whereas Dirt Road Blues is like, you know, it was recorded in an echo chamber. And then all the ones like Million Miles, they have this kind of deliberate distorted, putting the voice further away. It gives it a totally different musical sound, and they're much more Lanois. They're far more soupy. You know, when he sings in Cold Iron's Bound about feeling lost in a mist, well, you know, the way the track is recorded enacts that lostness in itself. So I don't think there's one overall sound. There may be one overall mood of desolation, but that's not the same.
Yeah, I don't know if you were able to watch that Mark Howard interview. He described how everything was recorded with two mics, one that has the compression distortion and one that doesn't, and that Dylan would basically come to him and dictate the percentage, you know, 50-50 or 70-30. And so it was, you know, Bob's behest, maybe. In other words, A, they were recorded the same, but B, the percentage of the distorted, you know, harmonica mic version versus the clean was different. And I was able to ask Mark, because people have, you know, kind of dreamed of the clean version of the album.
Yes.
And he seemed to think that was not forthcoming.
Oh, no, it was not forthcoming. It wasn't just the level of distortion that varied, was it? It was how far away it was, or how much, you know, in very simple terms, how much echo was on the voice. I mean, Dirt Road Blues, the vocal isn't particularly distorted, but it's very, very echoing.
Let's change gears a little bit, Michael. I'd love to hear your opinion both on the role of a critic and what does someone do with 1,000 pages of new information about Bob Dylan when they sit down to listen?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't try and define what all critics should be doing. But for me, it's a question of saying, of looking in detail at the work and trying to explain what it seems to be that's happening within that work, whether it's a song or whatever, and how are those effects achieved? And then to be saying, this seems to me to be so, is it not? That's the job. The job is not to say, when Bob sings Boondocks, he means, you know, his mother-in-law, or any of that stuff. And it's not the same as a review where you have to, you know, pull back and you have a limited number of words yourself. There's a value in detailed scrutiny. That's what I feel. Of course, I think there's a special difficulty with Dylan because it's so hard not to hear every song as Bob Dylan singing about Bob Dylan, which may be why, you know, so very, very few cover versions succeed, because basically we want it to be Bob expressing this stuff. And therefore it's very hard not to think of him as the persona in every song. But of course, he has often said that he isn't, you know, so every time he sings about You're the Love of My Life, you know, we shouldn't be working out which real human person that means. You know, of course, we all do it. We all do it. And with an album like Blood on the Tracks, how can you not? You know, there are so many of Dylan's expressions which which just evoke him because, you know, he brought them into being in the first place, you know. Even sort of jokey things that now are terribly familiar, but once when he first threw them out were very fun or very stylishly cool in a Dylan-esque way. For example, in Love Minus Zero, No Limit, when he sings that live, even in California in 1965, when people hear people talk over situations, draw conclusions on the wall, people laugh. Even in California, that's so fresh then, you know? But it's not only so fresh, but it's also so Bob. It's so Bob Dylan to have that kind of sideways take. So, you know, it's a little bit more difficult to be a critic of maybe any live person still alive or person who has been alive in your own lifetime than to be a critic of, you know, Shakespeare or Ralph Waldo Emerson, because you can read those poems in any voice you like, and you can apply it to anyone. It's very difficult not to apply Bob's voice to Bob. So there's a difficulty there. You know, maybe that touches on the whole question of interpretation. I mean, I wish I was, if I had $100 for every time someone had called me an interpreter, I would be quite rich, actually. And I don't regard myself as an interpreter at all. I mean, I have slipped into that sometimes with those personal songs, but I shouldn't, and critics shouldn't, you know. You should be paying attention to the detail of a line or the vocal delivery of that line, and you should be saying, look at what he affects here. And he does it this way, by this particular creative skill. This is so, isn't it?
That's a very interesting comment on covers and why they work and not. The expressiveness in his voice, or that the phrasing, you know, all that, which most people consider one of the magic elements of him,
yeah.
You know, they also can't do. I always think of them, they seem like they're concentrating on the word so hard, they aren't thinking of the meaning at all.
I think there are times when, actually, when you've heard Dylan singing a particular song 175 times in illegal concert bootleg recordings, then you can hear someone else sing that song. And actually, they do make you hear the words anew, you know, because Bob doesn't always pay that much attention to them himself in concert, you know. And a lot of us make the kind of rather foolish error of spending 90% of our listening to Bob time on live performances instead of the actual albums, which are often, you know, rather good.
Yeah. Well, that's also interesting, right? Because he talks about being a live performer and the studio things are done to enable the live. And
yeah.
I've certainly been caught at that, you know, maybe for years of once you get that volume of live shows, you want to go swim in it for a while. And then going back to the album is a whole new experience and refreshing.
Yes, it's often very refreshing. Yeah.
One last question on that. For a listener, for the, you know, new or less fanatical Dylan fan who suddenly learns of all this, you know, I've asked the people who we've talked about all the, and you actually, I notice in your book, you're probably, again, the first person who noticed all the allusions and all the references to old blues and music and so forth. But how do you think a listener should apply that to their listening, either your criticism or this knowledge of all this extra things that are buried in the music that they didn't know before?
Well, it's pretty easy now because everything is available to be listened to. You know, Robert Browning forgetting the words of his own poem when reciting them into a microphone. You can hear that if you want to. You know, you can hear any of these blues things. And so if it interests you to find that a particular phrase is from a specific 1931 recording, then you can go and listen to that 1931 recording, which ought to deepen your sense of what Dylan has done with it creatively. I mean, I think there are times when he doesn't, you know, when he just reaches for a convenient phrase. But the chapter of Song and Dance Man 3 about his use of the blues is, you know, 98% about how rejuvenating and creative that use is. And it's a chapter I remain particularly proud of, because it was achieved almost 98% was achieved before I had access to the internet, so that the research was infinitely more difficult and time-consuming than it was. This is why when I came to the Bob Dylan Encyclopedia, which is a longer book, 750,000 words, it was like working in a trice compared to Song Dance Man 3. But anyway, I don't know how interested people need to be. They don't need to be. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like his use of the Bible in his work. He usually gives you something, whether you get the allusion or not. And it may not be his intention that you should always have to pick up that allusion, you know. He's not always being a kind of didactic teacher. But usually you get something if you don't pick it up, and you get something more if you do. An example from the Bible, which I think Christopher Ricks used years and years ago, is that track from one of the evangelical songs. Soon as a man is born, you know the sparks begin to fly. Well, that's quite a nice line, but it's a nicer line if you can hear rumbling underneath it from the King James Bible, man is born unto trouble as the sparks fly upward. Now, you know, there can be no doubt there that Dylan has modernized, has reached for and rejuvenated that line. And yet, if that passes you by completely, you're still savoring a good Dylan line.
Yeah.
Not everybody wants to, you know, go that deep. You know, I don't know now, but one of the problems with American audience recordings has always been that a considerable irritating percentage of the audience is talking to each other about cheeseburgers while Dylan is singing. And similarly, all over the world, for decades, there would be people near the front shouting, "Maggie's Farm!" Regardless of, you know, in other words, not paying much attention to what Dylan wanted to sing, just wanting to hear some rocker.
Yeah, well, that problem still exists. Some cities better than others, for sure. You mentioned earlier when you reread the book, you having a positive reaction to kind of the close reading and the detailed inspection that you had done. I know you've got a passage you were willing to read, and could you do that?
Okay, well, I can do that. I think it explains itself in terms of showing what detailed scrutiny can yield that you wouldn't necessarily yield on a casual listen. And rather than taking it from one of the four major songs, I wanted to take an example from one of the songs that musically I'm not keen on, and production-wise I'm not keen on, and that is a little bit from Million Miles. Okay. There is interesting writing and hints at themes one could wish him to expand on inside all the songs. In the third verse of Million Miles, there is that engaging metaphor for trying to escape from guilt and regret, where he sings of throwing all my memories in a ditch so deep. which is never expanded upon and so stands alone, a one-liner metaphor that draws us in by its mix of stating so futile a task in so vivid a phrase. That vividness reveals the fervor of his desire to eliminate the past, while the choice of metaphor, a ditch so deep, draws upon the core psychological metaphors of pushing down, of suppression, of subterranean placement, the very metaphors by which Freud taught the 20th century that thrusting memories out of sight is not at all the same thing as escaping them, that you cannot push, as it were, bad time out of mind. That's just a short thing, but it's my critical apparatus at work, and I would stand by it. I mean, he goes on later to sort of add to that. I say it's a one line, standalone thing, but actually a little bit later, he does, if you like, connect to that again. In a verse later, where he sings, I need your love so bad, turn your lamp down low. I need every bit of it for the places that I go. And leaving aside that I need your love so bad is in itself, despite its inherent anonymity, a phrase we might recognize from its prominence on the record, Need Your Love So Bad by Little Willie John, and later by Fleetwood Mac. What we have here is that turn your lamp down low, an exhortation familiar to us from many an R&B song. What Dylan achieves is to use the phrase unaltered while letting context transform its meaning. Here, that love light must be turned down low to conserve it, as Dylan takes it with him, a miner's lamp, to light his way through the dark tunnels of the places I must go. Clinched by that unobtrusively intense, I need every bit of it. It takes a phrase from the common corpus of the blues, only to revitalize it with the particularity of Dylan's usage. It's a beautiful appropriation.
Yeah, well, that's a wonderful example of the kind of revelation or the insight that comes from reading this chapter and all of your work. I've actually grabbed a few paragraphs from the four masterpieces or best work that you think. I'd love to read a couple lines and see if it inspires any further thought for you. The first is about Dylan's singing and ability to communicate with his voice. In Trying to Get to Heaven, Dylan sings the simple touching couplet, every day your memory goes dimmer, it doesn't haunt me like it did before. And once you've heard him sing this, it's quite impossible afterwards to encounter the word in any other poetic context without it coming through via the immaculately alluring mediation of Dylan's voice. But you go on to reference another place where the word memory, you encounter memory in someone else's writing.
Yeah, I find Dylan. Don't you find this all over Dylan's work? That you just hear a phrase and and if he has used it, then every time you hear it, in however common a phrase it is, forever afterwards, it's like, you know, you're reaching out for that. You're touching that Dylan song again. Yeah, it's something he does. I mean, you know, I think that there's far more of Shakespeare in the English language than there is of Bob Dylan. But once Bob Dylan's used a bit of the English language, whether it's Shakespearean or not, it's the Dylan usage that echoes in your mind. In that particular quote, there's a nice one of his oral puns, A-U-R-A-L, oral puns. When he sings haunt, he sings it very close to hunt. And so it's only when you see it written down that you just plainly see haunt. When you hear it, you're hearing haunt hunt. And he likes those oral puns, I think.
Here's one talking about the music, which, as you say, often you're talking about the words. After the third verse comes the most plaintive, still small-voiced harmonica passage you could conceive of, sticking as nearly as possible to a rhythmic repeat on one note,
and with a tone reminiscent of the harmonica on Joker Man, coloring in with this different brush of the mood of exquisite yearnings that alternates with one of bleakness all through this turbulent, aching song.
Good, I like that. The thing is, that's the whole album is about that sort of, you know, he says, "I'm sick of love," but then almost all his songs are about love, and on this album, they're about yearning for lost love, but they're also just as centrally about the futility that he is feeling about life. So you have this yearning for love and this desolate feeling, and the whole of Time Out of Mind juggles with these two, and of course he interconnects them. Perhaps it's only when you're feeling that life is desolate and futile that you decide to be yearning for love rather than, getting on with the life and love you have.
There's one where we get to the humor of Dylan. This bleakness is immediately articulated in the words of the classic lines that follow, lines that yield such a triumphant Bob Dylanism that they make you laugh to hear it, even though its humor is that of black despair. They tell me everything is going to be all right, but I don't know what all right even means.
Yeah, that's very Dylan-esque, isn't it? I love that.
And it does bring a chuckle the 50th time.
Yeah. And then another thing which I think I talk about when we're looking at Not Dark Yet is the way that he enacts what the words say, just by, not only by the delivery of the words vocally, but by whether they fit comfortably into the line, so that discomfort can be expressed by his phrasing, as well as by the vocal emphasis, the tone of voice, and the words themselves. And in Not Dark Yet, the clearest example of that is when he sings, "I don't even remember what it was I came here to get away from." And, you know, his voice wriggles through this kind of, this throwing your hands up in the air and this, you know, this burrowing through the earth to get out. It's enacted by the phrase, by the fact that there are, you know, too many syllables really to fit the line. But Bob Dylan can always fit too many syllables into a line, as well as by his expression in the vocal and the words themselves. It's a wonderful line and it's wonderfully delivered.
Well, that coincidentally was a piece I had pulled. I'll just read the paragraph that precedes your commentary. Whether the line announces an omnipresent consciousness of the comparative imminence of actual death, or a consciousness that everything once worth savoring in life is losing its meaning, one of the things on offer here, as on trying to get to heaven, is the sojourn of defeat. It is never more perfectly rendered than in the quiet achievement in the song's concluding verse of the line, "I can't even remember what it was I came here to get away from."
Yeah, I'm pleased that we both alighted on that line. It's a great line.
All right, my last one about the wonderful highlands, of which your exposition is particularly interesting and illuminating. I really loved that idea that you express and go through about highlands not being one specific place, but being a amalgamation and a perhaps illusory location. The all-encompassing sweep of Highlands is constructed with genius, fussing into one three-dimensional portrait of the high and black comedy, the Dylan-esque sarcasms and off-the-wall observations, all of which are plentiful, authentic, and delivered as faultlessly as anything in his back catalog. And set against these, the recurrent expression of yearning for a better version of himself and the world, for a renewed sense of moral cleanliness, as well as an unsullied terrain of natural grandeur, while all but confessing that what his eyes are raised to is Never Never Land. All of this is performed with an unshakable, wise, good-natured authority that trusts the form even as it achieves a larger expansion of its possibilities, and acts in good faith and addresses itself to an intelligent audience, creditably belying its writer's composer's claim to have lost his conscience and sense of humanity. In doing this, Hyland's acts as the best possible conclusion to the album, achieving, just as the final lines of the song do, a farewell bow of dignified, painfully graceful, limited optimism, dragging back from the turbulent labyrinths of despair and decay.
Thank you. Yeah, that's what I feel. And I think I say somewhere about that, you know, what he's taking there, he's taking something from Robert Burns, Scottish poet. But really, when you read the Robert Burns, it's kind of doggerel. It's not a great literary poem at all. But what Dylan does with something does with it is to elevate it. Yeah. And I love one of the lines where he says, I'm going to go there when I feel good enough to go. And that encapsulates so much of what he's been struggling with all through the album.
How do you think the length plays on that song? Meaning, is the reaction a little bit because of the length? Does the length allow him to do something that he couldn't in 6 minutes?
I think he probably could. And you know, we all know that the longest songs are always proclaimed to be masterpieces just because they're the longest.
Well, that's why I ask, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, on Highlands, I have a friend who's a good judge of Dylan's work, who was very, very early to be extremely enthusiastic about Rough and Rowdy Ways, who feels that the whole sequence in that song with the waitress spoils the song, and that therefore, if it were shorter by having that section cut out, the song would not be a lesser thing, but greater. I'm not sure that that's ever how I've felt about it, but I quite like quite a lot of the bits in the waitress sequence. I like the way that he says, she studied me closely as I sat down. And then the next line is, she had a pretty face and long, white, shiny legs. I.e., he was studying her closely as he sat down. Although he says, she studied me closely as I sat down. He immediately tells you this detailed description of her. I like things like that. Yeah.
I mean, unexpected is always something we get, and that song is certainly full of those lines. As you've probably heard, there's a rumor we're going to get a Time Out of Mind bootleg series. Is there something you're looking forward to, or maybe I want to ask you how the bootleg series have changed your views of albums, but that's probably...
I try not to let it change my views. And, you know, I don't... With other artists, certainly, you know. I like, I like Astral Weeks the way it was, you know. And I don't need to hear... And I like the 1960 album Elvis Is Back. I like it. It's great the way it is. It doesn't need 14 outtakes. With Dylan, it's different, of course, because of course one has a compulsive interest in hearing everything. Because I, you know, have such mixed feelings about Time Out of Mind, I am less voraciously keen to hear everything possible from that. And we never quite get everything possible, do we, with these bootleg series. But on the other hand, it'll certainly be interesting. It'll be extremely interesting. I'm wondering whether there's a version of To Make You Feel My Love, which which includes the really terrible lines that are on the lyric sheet as published on BobDylan.com, where after the rolling sea and on the highway of regret, the words go, "Put your hand in mine and come with me. I'll see that you don't get wet."
I mean, I didn't.
That's on BobDylan.com for the lyric of "Make You Feel My Love." And you know, is there a worse line in all of Bob Dylan's work? I hope not. wet is certainly the word. Yeah. So, of course, and you know, when he alters that to "You Ain't Seen Nothing Like Me Yet," you know, that's because even he can't quite bring himself to sing, or at least maybe he does on, you know, take three or take one, whatever. But at least he doesn't. At least he spares us that on the recording on "Time Out of Mind." But on the other hand, the line that he gives us instead, "You ain't seen nothing like me yet," is a swaggering, boastful, unpleasant sort of line in itself, isn't it? I mean, if someone says that to you in your real life, are you going to like that person for saying that? Yeah, I'll be very interested in Laura's defense of this.
Yes.
Terrible song.
Well, I've purposely stayed away from reading some of your quotes about the song from there. But one thing I will ask you about it is if you subscribe to the idea that its placement in the sequence, being the only piano song, being a mood breaker of sorts, serves a useful function in the sequence of the album, even if, you know, what happens for those 3 or 4 minutes aren't your favorite.
Not me. Not for me. It's not a use. It doesn't do anything to cheer me up or make the sequence better, because it comes in a run of three songs that I don't like at all, which are "Cold Iron's Bound," "Make You Feel My Love," "Can't Wait."
So does the Telltale Signs live "Cold Iron's Bound" inspire you anymore?
No, I don't like it live. I don't like him doing that kind of stuff live. I really like the slow alternate take of "Can't Wait" that we've heard from an earlier bootleg thing. I think that's actually a much more interesting. But the other thing I want to say more generally about this is that, of course, one of the things Dylan has always done is give us not the polished gem, but allowed us to see the process of his creativity, ebbing and flowing, things coming into being, being adjusted, being changed, and so on. And so, you know, nothing has been more valuable for a serious aficionado than the bootleg series, starting with Biograph. Biograph was the most wonderful release in 1985, I mean. And wow, look at the stuff on it. Time and time again, you just say any other artist would have regarded one of those rejected tracks as the most brilliant thing they'd ever done by a mile. You know, it's not just Blind Willie McTell where you think, what? This work of genius was not on the album. There's loads of things, you know, and some of them are right there on Biograph, and there's always something. And you know, however much you feel that this isn't as good as that and blah, 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 the bootleg series gives us a magnified version of the process. We see how he arrives from here to there, or we're given a version of the process, but it's still being selected, and quite right too.
Have you, given the pandemic, perhaps not, but have you had a chance to go to Tulsa and to see the archives and get access to anything you might not have, that wasn't available to anyone before?
I haven't had the chance. I wish I had. I would, I'm particularly excited by things like the outtakes from Street Legal. I would be particularly keen on that little bit of footage that we've seen about 2 seconds of him at the piano in about 1970 from either the New Morning Session or one of those. And also, apparently, Clinton Halen, who has been in the archives snuffling around a good deal, he says that in the period that gave us Love and Theft, there is a whole other album from that time.
Wow.
Well, that would excite me hugely, because I've always felt that Love and Theft was the one great album he's made in the 21st century. And not even, you know, not even Rough and Rowdy Ways. It's a sort of a minority opinion, but it's opinion that many people share.
Michael, I could easily speak with you for days. This has been wonderful. I do want to point people to your latest compilation, Outtakes, the only one I have on Kindle, but it was the fastest way to grab it. This was wonderful, Michael. Thank you for doing this and sharing all you do with the Dylan community, but particularly in coming and talking to us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening.